Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Honestly, my radio was old and mangy. It was on its last legs. All I could get was staticky mainstream media programs. My face, my elbows, my ears ached from all the junk I listened to. I thought I was going to have to put the radio down. You know, like Hunter Thompson in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Plug in the old thing, put on Jefferson Airplane's White Rabbit, get in the tub, and when the song reached the climax, have my husband throw the radio in the water. Just get it over with. My son heard the commercial for Dynamike.
Dinomike.
The Mike Novak Show.
Carrots, beets, broccoli, organic potatoes, spelt and gluten-free bread. The important conversations that are cooked out of other radio shows.
After listening for 2 hours on Sunday, my radio was like new again. It was the most amazing thing. When he tells bad jokes, it brings tears to my eyes. But the inside of my belly has cleared up.
773-763-9278. 773-763-9278.
The Mike Novak Show.
Dinomike.com.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Angie's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a pierogi's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere. It's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program, heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes, true currents and thriving seas, wind blowing through breathing trees, strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find.
If Mike says he's growing a pear, he's literally growing a pear. What did you think he meant? Get your minds out of the irrigation ditch. Here he is, Mike Novak.
This just in from the Chicago Tribune. One more time. Thank you. The bridge demolition work that forced closures on the Kennedy Expressway the last two weekends has come to an end early, officials said Sunday morning, and the roadway is reopening. Wait, that almost works. And that means that you, Sarah Batka, can go home with impunity.
That's good news. Really good news.
Now, what it means is that you can actually get home.
Thank you, IDOT. You did something good.
Wow. You know, that whole Carmageddon thing, they got that done quickly each time they shut everything down.
It's a lot easier to destroy than it is to build it.
Yeah, it's true. I think about that in terms of radio. I think you can destroy careers. It's easier to destroy careers than to build them.
One fell swoop.
Gardens, easier to destroy gardens. Oh, don't even look like that, Lamanda Joy. we had vandalism in our garden this year.
What happened?
A couple of times. For one time, somebody pulled the middle of five rain barrels down. The one in the middle, pulled it over, and it disconnected the hoses from the other two, broke off the spigot on the one that got pulled down, and drained all of the water, five barrels full of water, which is like
250 gallons.
And if it's not raining, it's hard to get that water, you know.
Well, we've had plenty of rain.
We have now.
Yes.
That was several weeks ago. Some of the gardens got trampled, stuff ripped out.
Really?
Yeah. And then we found out it was a couple of kids.
Of course. It's always kids.
Well, for a while we thought it was the gangbangers, you know?
Well, they're kids too, aren't they?
They are, but, you know, there's a difference between a 7-year-old kid and a 21-year-old kid.
Okay. All right.
Or an 18-year-old kid who's doing that. And if the 18-year-old kids are doing it, they're really, really stupid. If it's a 7-year-old kid, you kind of go, well, okay. Don't do that. And then they lied to us. One of the kids who did it said, I know who did it. I saw these two kids over there. And this was early on. And we went, wow, that's something. Okay. And then a couple of weeks later, Kathleen, oh, God love her. She's sitting at home one evening we had cleaned everything up, and she just had a hunch. She said, school gets out at 3:45. I'm going over there at 3:45.
Good.
And she goes over there, and nothing.
Oh.
Nothing happening. And then she goes back to work at the computer, and then around 6, she just had another hunch. She said, I'm going over there. She walks over there, sees the two kids vandalizing the garden.
Red-handed, huh?
Right. And including the one who said it was other kids who did it.
Oh, that wasn't your little buddy guy that helped so much, is it?
It was one of our little buddy guys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's what was so discouraging. Yeah. So she did the coolest thing. See, I'm glad it wasn't me, because if it was me, you know, I'm not exactly good with kids. Kathleen, here's what she says to these kids. She says, well, you know, I hate to tell you this, but you're going to have bad luck now. You're going to have bad luck because, you know, you mess with the community garden, that's bad luck. And, of course, the very first thing that happens is the kids, they get on their little scooters and start to ride away, and the one kid falls down immediately, just goes,
and
bam!
Wipes out.
Bam!
I mean, I feel bad we're laughing at a kid falling off his scooter. But
I think of it, bad luck. Sorry. Bad luck. Sorry, we shouldn't be laughing because we were, you know, a little upset about things, but it worked and, you know. We've been fine ever since. Do I get to knock on wood or for Micah here or... So, oh, wait. Knock on my frog.
So, Mike, what's the status of Green on McLean? I know that you said the property had gotten sold.
The property's
right?
been sold.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, unfortunately. I wish we'd have found out. We didn't... It went into foreclosure. Then it got sold before we could do anything about it. And the construction company bought it. I don't know what they're going to put there, but we're assuming it won't happen before the end of the year, that nothing will happen. So,
we got
a season here.
Okay.
The problem was, because of that, we just thought we got to cut corners here. There's no point spending money that...
No perennials.
Well, we have perennials in there, which we've had for years, but we didn't buy any fresh soil. Normally, we get fresh compost. Speaking of soil and soil mania, which is the second hour of the show today. So we're kind of doing it with last year's soil and fertilizer, or organic fertilizer. And you know what? Things are growing great.
Yeah, that's fine. You know, new stuff every year.
We like it, though. You know, it's amazing what a difference it makes.
It can.
But we've put stuff in and it all looks good. It still looks great, and we wish we had it for another, forever. And I don't know what we'll do afterward. I've been talking to Ben Helfand from Open Space and Neighbor Space. Neighbor Space. Hello.
You just joined them together.
Open Lands and Neighbor Space. Yeah, Open Space. that's the way my mind doesn't work. We'll just go through the season and see what happens. And yeah, the great thing for me, of course, it's right across the street.
Yeah.
I don't want to walk to another garden.
Maybe you could sweet talk the developer into putting a rooftop garden on the building.
Whatever. It just sounds like a lot of effort.
A lot of work.
It sounds like a lot of work. Good morning, everybody. It's Lamanda Joy from, speaking of community gardens, from the Peterson Garden Project. And she's here today not as a representative of the Peterson Garden Project. Or, now where's the book? All right, wait. I've got it here.
It's Fearless Food Gardening.
Yes, right. Yay! Here. See, I got my copy of Fearless Food Gardening that...
carrots and capes on the cover.
Yeah, right. And that Lamanda and who's your co-author?
Teresa Gale.
They put this together earlier this year for the Peterson Garden Project. But now we'll get to you in a second. You got other stuff going on here. But if you guys should pick this up. If you're listening, it's good for USDA hardiness zones 5 and 6. That's us. Here we are, folks, right in Chicago. And it's a wonderful, wonderful basic book with lots of great illustrations about growing stuff. Some stuff I still learn from it and food, it's foodie stuff. and how to do your own gardening, and how it, and it, and the subtitle is a month by month growing guide for beginners. So we know where we stand.
That's
if,
right.
If you pick this up. And I'll bet even people who have done it before are going to enjoy it and learn, and, you know, be refreshed on things they had forgotten. But that's not why LaManda is here.
No.
She's here because the American Community Garden, is it gardening?
Gardening, yes.
American Community Gardening Association is having its 35th anniversary celebration right here in Chicago, right here in August. And we're going to talk about that. And they started in Chicago.
Yes.
So it's back to the roots.
That's right, back to the roots.
And in just a couple of minutes, we will have Dr. Mary Ann Krasny, who is from Cornell in the Civic Ecology Lab, and she's one of your keynotes there. And LaManda, of course, is on the board of the ACGA, which is why she's here, because nice to have somebody in the city who can just wander into the studio and talk about that. So that's in the green room in just a couple of minutes. And then Rick DeMaio weather at 9:45, of course. Why is it raining so gosh darn much? What happened to the 90-degree temperatures? We'll ask him all that good stuff. He'll be around. And then, I am really stoked about this. Get ready to geek out on soil in the second. And it's interesting because the first hour and the second hour actually kind of go together. The whole idea of community gardening, because it's a lot of it's urban. Not all of community garden is urban. Some is suburban, some is exurban, but a lot of it's urban. And if you're dealing with gardening in the city, you're dealing with soils and trying to figure out what your soils are like. Well, next week there is another conference called Soil in the City. And that is a three-day thing. I don't know. A lot of days. And a lot of scientists. It's just amazing. And I've got some folks, some scientists here, all on the phone, none of them in the studio, because they're all coming into town next week. And they are going to talk about soils and contaminants and biosolids and really geeky stuff that I love. And I think you will, too, because I was told by Dr. Lockwinder Hundahl, who's the conference chair. He happens to work for the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District, and he helped me put this cast of characters together. He says this might, let's see, I actually wrote it on my website, mikenovak.net. Dr. Hundahl said this could be the first show to have three world-renowned experts to talk about urban soils and contaminants.
Woo-hoo!
The Mike Novak Show. Nobody else is doing this, folks. Nobody else wants to, but that's okay, too. I'm happy to do it because I think it's interesting. And so Sally Brown, who is from the University of Washington, Rufus Cheney from the USDA. He's a research agronomist. And Ganga Hediarachi from Kansas State University. And I think I even pronounced it correctly. We'll be here in the second hour and the whole hour. And I hope you call 773-763-9278 to talk about soils. So let's get to the 35th anniversary of the American Community Garden Association. And we will do that in just a second. So you think nothing good ever came out of a rum distillery, you ask? Ha! Who are you? And haven't you heard of Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew? The secret ingredient in Bonide's all-organic insect control, spinosad, was discovered on a Caribbean island in an abandoned rum distillery, and now it strikes terror into the hearts of all those pests that are munching on your plants. Can I get an R?
R.
Very good, LaManda. Come on, Sarah. I want an arg.
Arg.
Okay. Helen? Give me an arg. Carol?
That was so good. Can I? Do I?
Yes, you need
to. It?
Yeah.
No laughing.
This fast-working and effective product works two ways, on contact or when the insect feeds. Captain Jack's controls all kinds of insects, and you can use it on vegetables, berries, and other fruit, flowers, trees, and shrubs. Captain Jack's all-organic insect control comes in an easy-to-use dust or a liquid concentrate, as well as ready-to-use and ready-to-spray containers that have built-in applicators. Let me ask you, plead with you, to read and follow label directions and to have an idea why you're using it. Please identify insect pests. Please identify disease pests before you use any product in your garden. Pick up of some of Bonide's Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew today at Alsip Home and Garden in St. John's, Indiana. Hawthorne Woods in Hawthorne Woods. I'm sorry, Hawthorne Gardens in Hawthorne Woods. Yeah, Hawthorne Woods would be in Hawthorne Woods. And LaGrange Park Ace in LaGrange, or go to Bonide.com, Bonide.com, to find a retailer near you.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I don't want you to be left out. Here's what I'm talking about. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakening Chicago to improve their lives than any other health or wellness magazine. If you're a green, natural health, or wellness business, you should be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Natural Awakenings is packed with information that our readers use to find the products and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is available for free each month throughout the city and north and northwest suburbs. We're placed in more than 1,100 area locations, ensuring the right eyes read about your products and services. We're also online at nachicagonorth.com. We're local, we're independent, and our readers will help you grow your business. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
This is Mike Novak with a message from the Illinois Hydrilla Task Force. Dense mats of aquatic plants at your favorite fishing spot or swimming hole can really get in the way of summer fun. You can help protect Illinois' lakes and streams by keeping a lookout for the aquatic superweed hydrilla. It's already been found in neighboring states and impacted boating, fishing, and water sports. To learn more, go to hydrillahunt.org and report any suspicious aquatic plants you find. Your neighbors and fellow water users will thank you.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
It's time to step in the green room.
Life's a garden, dig it. You make it work for you.
In the Green Room with Mike is brought to you by Christy Weber Farm and Garden at CWFNG.com. Let them inspire you to create your own oasis.
And as I mentioned, because she's sitting here right in front of me, and I really wouldn't want to ignore her. Amanda Joy from the Peterson Garden Project is here in the studio. And on the throne, yes. I can't say anything this morning. Dr. Marianne Krasny, who's the director of the Civic Ecology Lab in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University. Dr. Krasny, good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you on the program this morning, and I'm glad you're coming into town for the 35th anniversary gathering of the American Community Garden Association. Gardening Association. Yeah. That's right.
It's going to confuse you all morning.
It is going to confuse me all morning, and you know, it's because I work up these cheat sheets, and sometimes I'm moving really, really fast, and if I happen to get that wrong. I'm glad to have you both here, and it sounds like a great time for about three days, a little more than 3 days, right, Amanda? And you guys are going to start with a visit to one of my favorite community gardens, which is KAM Isaiah Israel and Robert Neville on the south side in Hyde Park. And of course, one of the reasons we're talking about this is to get people interested in who are interested in community gardens to sign up and be part of this. Well, let me tell you something. If you go down to KAM Isaiah Israel, you're going to be really impressed. For one thing, Robert's an architect, and everything, you know, everything grows in straight lines down there at KAM. They even have designs in the ground. They have a Star of David, and they fill that in, and it's pretty awesome. But, I mean, he's got a little OCD going on there, but that's okay.
Don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. Especially in our gardens. But that's also where you're going to have a dinner that evening too, right?
Yes, we're starting our pre-conference at KAM Isaiah Israel, and the topic of that conference, that's a half day on the Thursday before the event begins, August 7th, is Lost and Found, Rescuing Land and Food for Communities in Need. So it's going to be a discussion about food pantry gardens, gleaning programs, et cetera, which is a hot topic with community gardens.
Yeah, and that's one of the things they do so well down at KAM Isaiah Israel, which is the White Rock Gleaning Program, mm-hmm. which he introduced me to, you know, like 3 years ago or something. And the idea being, and it's really old school, which I love about it, is you put these rocks out in your garden and it's a sign, you know, no texting, folks, no emails, just put the... Gesundheit, Sarah. You just put these white rocks out there and people go by and say, oh, there's food for taking in that garden. And I guess they were able to get an extra 1,000 pounds of food last year or something like that.
Yeah, it's really a phenomenal program. And so they're joining with other organizers around the country that do similar programs to teach people how that all works. So that's going to be awesome. And that night is the welcome dinner, and Irvin Shelley's Fresh Picks are donating.
They're wonderful. I've had them on the show too.
Oh, fantastic people. And the LTH Forum is doing the cooking for us that night. So all of the people that are attending the conference are welcome to come to that welcome dinner. It's going to be really nice.
So the welcome dinner is also at KAM Isaiah Israel. You guys are kind of bouncing around from KAM to the Field Museum to Garfield Park Conservatory. There's that sort of a, the Field Museum is often a pickup point for people to get on a bus or transportation.
Actually, the Field Museum is the main venue for the conference. That's where all the workshops are happening.
Thank you for that.
All the keynotes, everything. And the tours will take off from there. All the transportation will be from there. So we'll be leaving on Friday night to go to Garfield Park for the 35th anniversary disco dance party garden soiree. So that's going to be super fun. But the majority
of it... Is there going to be dancing?
Oh, there's going to be dancing. If you're there, there's going to be dancing. I know that.
And I hope I am. That's great. Before we get into to all those presentations, I want to bring Dr. Krasny into this because I'm interested in your book that you co-authored called Greening in the Red Zone, which you say was inspired in part by Kenny Helfand's book, Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime. And you might have heard the word Helfand on the show because Ben Helfand is with a neighbor space that I misidentified a few minutes ago. That's his father. So Dr. Krasny, maybe you want to talk about that a little bit in terms of the moxie it takes to put a community garden together.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah, and this KAM Isaiah Israel garden sounds really exciting. You all are making me really excited about wanting to get back to Chicago. So, but when you think about community gardens, you can think about sort of, you know, maybe your listeners or you all in the studio want to think about what a community gardens create for the community or what do they offer for the community. And food is obviously a big one. And KAM Isaiah Israel Garden, I guess, produces thousands of pounds of food. And I love that idea, the rock, white rocks, telling people the food's available. But you can see that, you know, people coming to this garden, it's also creating a community, a sense of community, place for people to socialize, tell stories, create social capital, foster community well-being. And then, of course, community gardens create beautiful spaces amid concrete and asphalt. So when you think about sort of people in these gardens and where they are, one of the things that we've found is that people are often using these places where they can produce something valuable, food, but also something valuable for the community, but also nature, a place where they can kind of reflect, a refuge, so to speak, from what's going on around them. A lot of the people that come are people that might be dealing with displacement. Maybe they're refugees or they're living in very stressed or disinvested communities like we see in Detroit. And so a lot of what community gardening is also a place where people can express sort of their own resilience and be resilient or even defiant, as Kenny Halpin, Ben Halpin's father, talked about. So I think that getting back to his book, it's about defiant gardens, and a lot of the gardens that he talks about are gardens during wartime. He starts out with an example of a World War I garden in the trenches that the French soldiers had created. So in these very, very difficult conditions, whether they're in cities today or in wartime or even after things like hurricanes in New Orleans, people often turn to greening. And that's where we got the name of the book, Greening in the Red Zone. So these, whether they're sort of stressed neighborhoods in cities or wartime or after disasters like hurricanes, these are what we call red zones. And then community gardening is just one of a number of responses people have to create something that helps them to be resilient as well as their communities to be resilient.
You know, Marianne, you could have talked to me before writing that book, because my own community garden, Green on McLean, it was really a response. It wasn't about growing food. It was a response to gang presence in my neighborhood. And we really fit into that category, the gardening in the red zone, because we feel like it sometimes, literally for a while, we were in the crossfire. And we kind of rose up as a community and say, enough, we're done. We're done with that. We're going to do what we can to change it. Took this lot, which was basically the drug corner, and we turned it into a community garden, complete with park, because it's half shade and half sun. So the shade area, we mow the lawn and people come out and have picnics. And then in the sun area, we grow food. But in a sense, we really don't care how much food we grow. It's about the process. I mean, obviously, we love to harvest the stuff, but that was not the primary consideration. And what you're saying, I think, relates to that.
Yeah, I think that same kind of pattern we see repeated across the U.S. and really around the world. And there's a really beautiful example in Manhattan, the north part of Manhattan in Ishman Park, of a guy named Mr. Reynolds, who in, I guess, around the 70s, 80s, he moved to that area, and there was a lot of gang activity, so he didn't want his teenage son to get involved. And so together they created a community garden with the other youth, the other teens in the community. And then, tragically, his son was a first responder after 9/11 and perished at the World Trade Center. And his dad, for a while, just couldn't go out of the house at all. But the Dutch, the Netherlands, they had contributed some bulbs, and they were leaving them on the sidewalks in New York City. And Mr. Reynolds eventually sort of came to think that if he didn't go out there and do something, these bulbs would rot. And so he went out and he went back to the garden in Ishman Park, and he sort of revitalized it as a post 9/11 garden, and it's now called Bruce's Garden. It's a beautiful space up in northern Manhattan. And so you see sort of the red zone of the gangs that you're talking about, but the red zones after a major tragedy or disaster.
Mm-hmm. I had not heard of the story of the trenches in World War One. That's pretty remarkable.
It is.
Given how horrific that whole situation was. But again, as it points out, people will, they will defy fate. They will defy their circumstances in order to create something better. And so is that sort of what you'll be highlighting in your keynote talk?
Yeah, I'll be talking about that. And that a lot of this work is also of the work of my colleague at Cornell, Keith Tidball, who's the first author or editor on the book Greening in the Red Zone, and he talks about this phenomenon known as urgent biophilia. So biophilia is just humans' innate love of nature, And he feels that after disaster, oftentimes people have this urgent need to return to nature. So that's one of the things I'll be talking about. But I'll also be talking about more generally civic ecology, because both Dr. Kidball and I feel that community garden is not the only action that humans take to restore community and nature in cities or places that have experienced disaster. So, for example, Keith Kidball worked in tree planting. He went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and he saw not only community gardening as a response, but also community tree planting. Again, sort of expressing this resilience or resistance that we're in, trees being a symbol, sort of the live oaks of New Orleans and their rootedness and resistance. But I think there's other examples of these civic ecology practices that integrate environmental and community well-being and restoration, and many of them are in Chicago. Many part of the Chicago Wilderness Network. One of the ones that we featured in our upcoming book, which is called Civic Ecology, Adaptation and Transformation from the Ground Up, is a project of Ben Haberther, who's an Iraq war vet, and he's working to involve vets through an organization he founded called the Veterans Conservation Corps of Chicagoland in Kane County, and they're working to restore the Dick Young Forest Preserves. But like community gardens, they also have family events, barbecues, and so forth. So they're restoring sort of community and nature, but also helping the vets to reintegrate back into the communities in the U.S.
That's Dr. Marianne Krasny, who's a professor and director of the Civic Ecology Lab at Cornell University. Lamanda Joy from Peterson Garden Project is here. We're talking about the 35th anniversary gathering in Chicago of the American Community Gardening Association. Let's get to some of the stuff that's going to be there, Lamanda. 40 workshops or 40 presentations, roundtables, workshops, including advocacy and social justice. That's a KAM Isaiah Israel thing. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Krasny, you might know this, you might not. I hope you're in town for the KAM thing, because it's right across the street from President Obama's Chicago home. So if you go down there, you will get to make nice with the Secret Service.
That's the added bonus.
That's the bonus. Okay. You get to meet a real live Secret Service person, because they will be watching you quite intently. You're going to be talking about community garden management, conservation and green infrastructure, food gardens and urban farms, gardens and culture, youth and school programs, urban animals, and others. Tell me about some of those presentations, Lamanda.
Sure. Well, you know, we've got people coming from all over the U.S. and Canada, and we actually have some international people coming as well, and they're talking on all sorts of topics. You know, we tried to break this down into categories that correspond with the ACGA website, because the organization, you know, lives on year-round, and we have, you know, community garden leadership needs year-round. So a lot of these categories are things that have been of interest or have been identified by our members as the things that matter most to them. You know, just an interesting thing. There's a lot of confusion often between food gardens and, you know, community gardens and urban farming. And so that dialogue is happening at this conference. You know, what's the difference? Is there a difference? Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Also, school gardens and community gardens often get mashed in together. They are exactly the same but different. So there's some conversation around youth and school programs.
Wait. They're not exactly the same.
And, exactly the same but different.
I know. I hear what you're saying. But I look at both, and I think of really two incredibly different sets of circumstances.
They are, but they do all get mashed in together. And so, as you know, the leading community garden organization in North America, we have to talk about those differences,
right?
How they're the same, how they're different, how some of the skills and needs of a community garden can translate to a school garden, and how some of the same needs from a school garden can translate to a community garden.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially a lot of shades of gray in some of these categories,
is
what it is. And so we very much try to define those and figure out how we can help in each of these areas.
And you look at one of the words in community garden, which is community. What is your community?
Exactly.
And as I have said before, and I'm sure you agree, without a community, you have no garden. You can have a garden, but without a community, you have no community garden. And
right.
It's not going to exist.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the big problems that's happening right now is that people are seeing community gardens as a way to make changes in their communities, as Marianne so succinctly put it, but they're only really thinking about building the garden. You know, people instantly want to talk about getting the lumber and the soil and how much do we need and do we need a bulldozer and all those things, when that's actually the really smallest part of it.
Yeah.
So if you want sustainability, you need to think about the community, who's going to be involved, who's going to take this garden on for the long term, and education. You know, it breaks my heart when I see these gardens going in and then there's no long-term education. That's part of the reason we wrote our book, is to, you know, help people understand what it takes to actually succeed in a garden. It's not something you do for one season. It's something that continues on and builds as the community goes. So, you know, the issues that we face here in Chicago are issues that everybody across the community garden world faces. And that, I think, is one of the amazing things about this conference, is that you get to hear how other people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world are dealing with the same issues. And there's just brilliant ideas. The networking alone is amazing. And, you know, this Kamaizei Israel event, you know, their leadership with the gleaning programs, that's something that's really hot and important right now with community gardens across the world. So it gives, this conference gives people a chance to really, you know, stop making the same mistakes all over the place and learn and fast track, you know, make these gardens more sustainable, easier, et cetera, and more long term.
Something I didn't realize, and I should have, is that the ACGA involves Canada. As well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, when we say American, we mean American in the broadest sense. You got to bring Mexico into it, too. But so it's United States and Canada.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one other interesting thing about these topics is we have one. We joke that this is going to be our band name, Urban Animals and Others. But we have, you know, there's honeybees are often part of community gardens. People sometimes have chickens. Sometimes people have small livestock. You know, those are interesting challenges in a community garden setting. So we added that category this year. And we have several presenters that are presenting on those topics because it's something that's encountered.
My new band name is Urgent Biophilia.
Yes.
Dr. Krasny, I'm going to steal that. I'm thinking that's going to have to be the subtitle of my show.
That's great, but you're going to have to attribute it to Keith Tidball, or else I'll get in a lot of trouble.
I can do that. By the way, for folks listening, all this information is on my website, mikenowak.net, M-I-K-E-N-O-W-A-K, .net, Dino Mike. And go to this week's show, and I've got the links to the American Community Gardening Association, which is communitygarden.org. See, it's the name is gardening, but the website is communitygarden.org. I have the link to, and then you know, when you go to that site, that's where you can sign up for the big event, and which is not until August 7th.
Correct.
So we've got a month, and we're trying to get people on board early.
So, well, early bird registration ends July 7th, so there's some savings there. So that's important if people want to register now.
Excellent. So you got like 2 weeks to do this and save some money. I also have the link to Dr. Krasny's book, Greening in the Red Zone. Also, Kenny Helfand's book, Defiant Gardens, Making Gardens in Wartime. All that stuff is there. So I always put that up there, and I just want folks to know that if they're panicking and they have no idea where to find it, that's where you find it. We need to wrap up here. Dr. Krasny, I'm wondering if you have any final words about the essence, the soul of community gardening.
For me, community gardens inspiration. I mean, I've been to a lot of community gardens in different countries, and you said American, but as Lamanda mentioned, there'll be people there from other countries. There's some inspirational gardens, for example, in post-war Bosnia that have been presented at the conference before. So it's really about going and hearing the stories of people who have experienced some incredible hardships, whether they be refugees or people living in kind of neighborhoods that you mentioned, Mike, and then making something really beautiful out of that. That's what they are for me.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the fact that you're doing this and that you took some time on a Sunday morning to be on my program. Have fun in Chicago, and I think it's going to be a great event.
Hopefully we'll see you there.
I hope so, too. Thank you, Dr. Krasny.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. And before I let you go, Lamanda, okay, you're a person who makes a guy like me crazy, because my very first...
My husband says that too. What's going on here?
And that's because I got my very first book coming out, and it's at the printer right now. All right. The Attack of the Killer Asparagus. So for those of you who signed on with the Kickstarter and have been waiting for the book, and I know there are other folks, and you're going to be able to get it. You can already order it at Around the Block Press. And you just go to aroundtheblockpress.com. And you, of course, you put out Fearless Food Gardening in Chicago, but you can't rest, can you? You've got to put out yet another book. I mean, I'm working on my first, and here you are doing your second within a year. And it's called Start a Community Food Garden, the Essential Handbook. And not only that, you got Timber Press to, look at her. She's like, I'm so cool.
Fist pumping.
Timber Press is the best. They are the best horticultural publisher, bar none, in America. Congratulations. So when does that come out?
That comes out in December.
Uh-huh. So are you, when you leave here, you're going right back to writing that as well?
Oh, no, it's written.
Is it done?
That's in design now, so I'll be looking at the first pages next week. I'm very excited.
Well, la-dee-da.
Yeah.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
Wow, two books in the same year.
Well, you know, this book, it's the book I wish I would have had when I started Peterson Garden Project. So hopefully, you know, along the lines of everything that's going on with the American Community Gardening Association conference, the more we can learn from each other and skip the dumb stuff so we can just focus on the community-based issues.
You know, here's an example, you know, and you were talking before earlier about getting the soil and building the beds. That's the easy stuff. But there's all kinds of little stuff that comes up, and I'll be in the garden and people will go, "Hey, Mike, what goes with onions?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I mean, I'll go online."
Sausage.
all I got to say to that is, thank you, Sarah Becca. But, you know, what do you grow next to onions? And I said, I'll look it up, you know, the plants that get along. And after, you know, if you've been doing this long enough, you know automatically what's there. But sometimes those little things are hard to remember.
Oh, and not even little things like that, the absolute basics we find in our gardens. You know, we have so many people gardening with us.
Yeah.
People have no relationship to food growing at all.
No, they don't. They don't know how to plant. They don't know how to water. They don't know how to fertilize. They don't know how to harvest. They don't even know.
They can't tell good bugs from bad bugs.
They can't tell lettuce from a weed.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's some real education that needs to happen. That's why we wrote our Fearless Food Gardening book, is because after teaching people for 5 years, we realized that it has to be absolute basic because people are scared. You know, they want to try this, but they're afraid that they're going to fail. Well,
yeah.
You know, unless they have good education and a place to garden, i.e. a community garden or a home garden or whatever, they are going to fail, you know? So it's really important that people that believe in community and believe in that food is an important thing for our society and we need to make that change. It's really important that people participate in things like the conference, things like Green on McLean, Peterson Garden Project. It's really important stuff.
So how's Peterson Garden Project doing this year?
It's rocking. You know, we have such an amazing, amazing group of people. We have almost 4,000 people gardening with us this year. We built two new gardens. One I'm super excited about is on the site of the nation's largest victory garden during World War II. That's at Northeastern University, so my history geek loves that. And the other new garden is up in Rogers Park, and that one is really phenomenal. I've never seen.
What's the location of that one?
It's Ashland and Howard.
Okay. All right.
You know, and
I know exactly where it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it was that giant Lerner newspaper lot.
Yes, yes.
And we've seen all sorts of communities come together to build these gardens. But this one, they are en fuego for this garden. It's unbelievable. They're so excited. And this one is different. All of our community gardens have stages, but this one has a very large community area. And so we're going to be doing a bunch of fun things like a movie night presented by Chipotle with starting in July, where people can come, bring a chair, watch one of the movies from the Chipotle film series, get dinner, get a burrito, and then have a conversation about food topics right there in the garden.
Well, when you're talking to Chipotle, get them to advertise on my show, okay?
I'll see what I can do.
You work on that, okay. Lamanda Joy from the Peterson Garden Project. I got to run, but thank you so much for coming down. And, you know, you'll be back soon.
Yes, thanks for all you do, Mike. We love you.
In the Green Room.
Yiddick.
In the Green Room with Mike has been brought to you by Christy Weber Landscapes at ChristyWeber.com. Right in your own backyard.
Mosquito bites are painful and itchy, and mosquitoes can carry West Nile virus and other diseases. But there's an effective organic way to kill mosquitoes. Mosquito Dunks are America's favorite organic mosquito killer because they kill mosquitoes before they are old enough to bite. The active ingredient in Mosquito Dunks kills mosquito larvae before they become flying, biting, disease-spreading adults. Just float a donut-shaped mosquito dunk in ponds, bird baths, fountains, rain gutters, or any place where water collects to naturally kill mosquito larvae. Mosquito Dunks are deadly to mosquitoes, but harmless to pets, people, fish, and other wildlife. Each mosquito dunk treats up to 100 square feet of water and will kill mosquito larvae for up to 30 days. So don't let disease-carrying mosquitoes ruin your summer. Stock up on mosquito dunks. You can find mosquito dunks and mosquito bits at home centers, garden centers, and hardware stores.
Hi, this is Ron Calgo from Mighty House. Remember that raffle the Illinois Solar Energy Association did last year where they raffled off a car? You didn't win? That's okay. I didn't either. The ISEA had so much success with the raffle last year that they decided to do it again. But this year, you have a chance to win an all-electric Tesla Model S and a Bosch 240-volt charger for only $100. The Tesla Model S is one sweet ride and was ranked best overall car by Consumer Reports this year. To have a chance to win, go to illinoisolar.org and click on the Tesla Model S link in the top left-hand corner. You can buy one ticket for $100 or four tickets for $300. Only 2,000 tickets will be sold. Net proceeds will fully benefit the Illinois Solar Energy Association, a nonprofit working to advance solar energy development throughout Illinois.
Bosch Home EV Charger will be installed for free if the winner is within 50 miles of Chicago. Drawing will take place on October 4th, 2014. There is no limit on the number of tickets that can be purchased. Need not be present to win. If less than 1,500 tickets are sold, then the drawing converts to a 50-50 drawing. Tickets are only valid if sold in the continental U.S. The winner is responsible for all taxes, title, and destination charges. See the rules and regulations page at illinoisolar.org for more details.
Is pain keeping you from enjoying gardening? Dr. Bonnie Flaster at River North Wellness Center has gentle and effective techniques to get you out of pain and back to doing what you love. Here are two quick tips. First, remember to stretch. Second, use a timer to make sure you take breaks. Come see her at River North Wellness Center and find more tips at rivernorthwellness.com or call 312-642-7545 to make an appointment with Dr. Flaster and get back to feeling good.
I can't figure out why I think this is Rick DeMaio's theme song, so let us bring in star meteorologist Ricky D. How are you, buddy?
I'm good, Mike. Should we, what was the name of that song again?
The name of the song I just played?
Yeah.
That is called So What by Pink.
So What? I like that. Hey, DeMaio, it's raining a lot.
And they talk about I want to start a fight. I don't know if it's in the... yeah, whatever. It's, you know, it's a girl band.
Well, I think Pink's great. I think in my old stomping grounds where I grew up, the so, in between the so and the what, we probably have a few other choice words to make it a little bit more meaningful.
Okay. I'm not going to go there, but that's fine.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Mike, do we now change the name of all our forest preserves to tropical rainforest preserves?
Holy smoke. I got it. As I was
a lot of rain last night, wasn't it?
As I was standing on my back porch yesterday evening, when the storm came through, which turned out to be more of a rain event than in my neighborhood than anything else. There wasn't a whole lot of lightning. There wasn't any hail. Although I know some other people had it, right?
Yeah, and there wasn't really a lot of wind.
No,
when it came through Chicago, it was kind of. It was kind of interesting when I was watching the evolution of this event, and it was you know, I heard a couple of people call it a derecho, which is a term for a line of a straight line strong wind event that lasts for a long period of time. This was not a derecho; it really wasn't. It was a squall line that evolved into basically, as you said, a heavy rain producer that moved across the area in about an hour and a half period of time. Now, even though there was a little bit of rotation on the northern edge of this line, which that's where there typically is. So think about something that's kind of bottom heavy. As it's bottom heavy, the bottom part is kind of spinning from about, say, 8 o'clock or the number eight on your clock to about the number five. You know, kind of rotates down, and the axis is at the top, and where, say, between 11 and 12 or so. And that axis was where some of the rotation was observed by the Weather Service folks down at Romeoville, and that's why the tornado warning was out. And there, you know, there was some rotation. There was a couple of, you know, areas that had some trees that were kind of blown down in a circular manner. But by and large, nothing from a standpoint of major severe weather. But boy, when something hits like that between 5 and 7 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and you have expressways like the Kennedy Expressway barely shut down, it creates a lot of angst trying to get into the downtown area, which is where I was going at that particular time. Lakeshore Drive became Lakeshore Flood Drive.
I can imagine. Well, you know, as I was saying, I was on my back porch, and my neighbor's gutter up on the third floor where it can't be reached, obviously the downspout is clogged. And so all of that water was just flowing out of that and down into my gangway.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. It was like a waterfall coming off of her house.
Right. It was almost like someone took a fireman hose on the bottom and turned it on and went up and out.
Yes, exactly. That's what it was like. And I thought, well,
Wisconsin Dells.
I really don't want this to last a whole lot longer because not good for my basement, which, you know, floods when you sneeze. So,
But you know, and for all the people out there who have situations where, you know, whether the homeowner is on the left or the right side, north or the south, east or west, and they have issues that affect you and they seem to go, well, so what? That's where I think people have to have a little bit more compassion and say, you know what, I'm sorry, I got to get this fixed. So I'm doing it for you. How's that?
I appreciate it. My neighbor is 92 years old, and
I'm sorry. That makes it a little bit more difficult, doesn't it?
Yeah, and last I checked, she was in the hospital. So it does make it tough.
More compassion and empathy at that point, or just go ahead and do it yourself, right?
I thought about it, but I'm not climbing anything that high. I'll hire somebody to do it, but I got Cowgill. Yeah. You listening? I need to unclog the gutter next door.
Hey, Mike, let's go through some of the numbers yesterday.
Okay, great.
1.22 inches at Midway, an even inch pretty much at O'Hare Field. It kind of moved through there a little bit quicker, but as this thing settled southward, which they typically do when they settle southward, they produce more rain. 2.68 down in Piatone, 2.5 inches at the Weather Service office down by Romeoville and just to the east end of Lockport. So the good news is most of that rain was going right into the Des Plaines River. 63-mile-per-hour winds were reported down at Crown Point. We had a couple of 60 and 70-mile-per-hour wind reports up around Lake and McHenry County. But really, when you look at it, each time it seems like we've gotten these heavy rain events, they really haven't lasted too long to the point where we have the flooding that we had around here, if you remember, last June, or at least last April, and we had some wet weather in June as well. So even though we're 4.68 inches at O'Hare officially, about 2 inches above normal, it's kind of come in spurts here and there, here and there, here and there, where even though some of the rivers and the forest reserves are flooding, we haven't had that major long-term flooding in, you know, people's neighborhoods and alleyways and basements. Obviously, other people have had, you know, some flash flood in the basements, but this has still been a very beneficial rain, and I think at this point now we are all like, okay, enough, but the pattern doesn't want to say enough. It still appears wet around here for the next 8 to 14 days, which is good, which could become significant by the end of the month.
Yeah. Wow. I was thinking about that, especially since I saw some forecasts a couple of days ago that we were going to be in the 90s. And then what happened there? Some people got really faked out by that, didn't they?
Yeah. I called one of the local radio stations because I heard the person who isn't a meteorologist, they just said, oh, we're heading into a heat wave. And I'm like, heat wave? Yeah, 3 days near 90 is really not a heat wave. And in the end, we only had one day, and that's when we barely cracked 89 out here. We had 93 at Midway. But each day was preceded by these massive thunderstorms across northern Iowa, southern Minnesota, southern Wisconsin, where you heard about some of the severe weather that went through the Madison area. And it's really tough to get into a heat wave when you have your bands of thunderstorms producing these massive 6 to 8 hour flood and derecho events with tornadoes, because you end up with a lot of what's called that debris anvil kind of cirrus outflow that basically translates southward. We had that both Monday and Tuesday. Then, of course, we had our amazing storm that came through here on Wednesday. And just about every time that we've had some big thunderstorms move over Lake Michigan, we get the dreaded lake breeze, and we go back into cold weather. I mean, I've never seen so many days of literally you can forecast three different parts of the day, and they're, each part is completely different. And I think you can agree to that to some extent.
Oh, my goodness. The Wednesday thing, I was playing softball, and I dressed in shorts and a T-shirt, and by the end of the evening, I was freezing to death.
Yeah, you were freezing. And you're probably sitting in the outfield looking up and going, guys, those clouds don't look too good.
Oh, they called the game because of lightning.
That was a good thing.
It was really smart. I was really glad they did.
Yeah. So anyway, so our forecast, I have to say, over the next 7 days, looks very similar to what we had the last 7 days.
Mm.
However, the pattern looks like it's shifting a little bit further east and a little bit further south. So the record rainfall that has occurred across southern Minnesota, believe it or not, the Twin Cities is right now about 0.3 inch from breaking their all-time record for the month of June. And we're only at the 22nd. So,
wow.
The heavy rain that has been across parts of Iowa, and I sent you some maps if you want to put it on your Facebook page, showing how much rain, nearly 500% across areas of the Midwest. That heavy rain should press east of us. And as I said last week, and when we talk again next week, which is today, we'll be talking about temperatures generally 3 to 4 degrees above average and probably an additional 2 to 4 inches of rain. So this time next week, Mike, we could be talking about the beginning of some flooding situation. Remember, flooding is a cumulative effect, and that's where we're headed at this point.
Yikes. Well, you know, we don't have droughts. And don't you wish we could take some of this rain and send it to California? Wouldn't that be nice?
And I'd love your conversation with the person about the community garden. I was at the farmer's market yesterday in Evanston. The strawberries, they're actually giving them away. That's what they are right now.
Oh, my.
support your community gardens and your farmer's markets. This is the best time of the year for that.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick DeMaio. We will talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Second hour, it's Soil Mania on the Mike Novak Show. I hope you give us a call, 773-763-9278.
The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
Well, hot and heavy, pumpkin pie, chocolate candy, Jesus Christ, ain't nothing please me more than you.
Oh, let me come close.
Well, this is home. This is my Sunday home, which is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. I'm so glad you were with us. As I mentioned before, the second hour today is soil. And we're going to get to that in just a second. Soil Mania. And I'm hoping that folks who have questions, we're going to be talking about urban soils. There's a conference coming up called Soil in the City. That starts next Sunday, the 29th. We've got some fabulous folks on the line right now. I can see we'll bring them in just a second. But I wanted to let folks know, first of all, that on my website, MikeNovak.net, on the homepage, there is, at the very top, in the center, CRC Recycling Survey, the Chicago Recycling Coalition, and as you know, I'm the president of the Chicago Recycling Coalition, volunteer position, we have just launched a survey. So if you are in Chicago, if you live in Chicago and you have opinions about recycling, And if you have, and if you live in Chicago, you do have opinions about recycling. I hope you will spend a few minutes. It's like 3 or 4 minutes. It's really quick. And help us out. We're gathering information about recycling services in Chicago. And we want you to take advantage of our survey and help us out. And the link is right there on my homepage. Just go to MikeNovak.net. Click on that. And like I said, the survey doesn't take very long at all. And I'm hoping that you will do that. And I'm going to remind you of that because we're going to have it up for a while. We're just trying to get as many folks as we can. And you know, if you have a listserv, you're involved in organizations, get that link out there to folks who live in Chicago. Sarah, I'm sure you're going to post this on Twitter.
I'd be happy to.
And I've already, okay, and Helen is posting that on Facebook. And we'll put it wherever we can so people can take advantage of that. The other thing, a couple of other things. Advocates for Urban Agriculture is doing a rooftop movie and mingle night featuring the documentary Edible City. That is this Friday, June 27th. You can, okay, now I got to find out. I better hit the link here because I'm not sure where it is. Am I missing something here, Helen? I'm looking for where it is. I don't see the location there. Okay. Stay with me, folks. Here it is. Okay. I don't have it's. Oh wait, there's the link. Okay, let's post this. Talk amongst yourselves.
Do you want us to look it up and we can update you here?
Yeah.
All right. We can
that would be all right. Here it is. Here's I've got the link. It is at Weiss Memorial Hospital rooftop farm. I knew it was on a rooftop somewhere. Friday, June 27th, 7:30 to 11:30 p.m., all ages, $7 admission. All proceeds will benefit Advocates for Urban Agriculture and Loud Grade Produce Squad. And so if you want to take advantage of it, it is the rooftop movie and mingle night. There'll be tours of the Loud Grade Produce Squad of the Rooftop Farm and Community Garden, a special screening of Edible City, craft beers from Sierra Nevada and Lagunitas. Is that how you pronounce this? Lagunitas. Tasty snacks and good times. Okay. So, I hope you take advantage of that. And finally, last but not least, well, actually, a couple of things. They're the annual energy fair, renewable energy fair, is in Custer, Wisconsin. That's going on today. I guess that's the final day of the 25th annual energy fair. And I also want to let folks know about the South Shore Farmers Market. Today is the first day, speaking of urban agriculture, of the South Shore Farmers Market at Rainbow Beach Park. It starts today, and it's every Sunday from noon to 5 at 79th and South Shore. You can find them on Facebook at South Shore Farmers Market. I hope they're doing some great stuff on the South Side, so you want to take advantage of that. All right, as I said, Soil Mania here on the Mike Novak Show in the second hour of the program. I'm going straight to the phone line and bring in Sally Brown, who's research associate professor from the School of Forest Resources at the University of Washington. Sally, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Okay. Now, I assume it's Dr. Brown. Is that correct?
It is.
Yeah.
I
imagine all you guys are doctors. Although you guys are modest. You don't always put it right out there in front of your biographies. I'm going to bring in also. I just lost Sally, Helen. I didn't do anything bad. All I did was hit the next button. So let's get Sally back. Meanwhile, Rufus Cheney, who's a research agronomist at the USDA. Rufus, are you with me?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to try not to hang up on you. All I did was hit that button, and bam, Sally was gone. And so hang on. I've got you locked in. Let's see if we can get Gonga here. Gonga Hedirachi is associate professor of soil and environmental chemistry at Kansas State University. Gonga, are you there?
Yes. Yes, Mike, I am.
All right, great. And did I do a reasonable attempt to pronounce your name?
Yes, that is fine.
Okay, it's great. We had Sally here a second ago. I hit a button, and then her phone line went away. But Helen's getting her back online, and you know she's probably still on the phone, which is you're probably getting a busy signal or something. But you folks are coming in to Chicago, and it's very exciting because I don't imagine that there are conferences like this very often about urban gardening. Are there, it's Dr. Cheney, I would assume, Rufus, right?
Yep.
Yep. You're all doctors here. Rufus, so tell me, how important is this conference?
Well, it's a leading conference of people who have been actually working to develop better science and recommendations for the public about what is safe urban gardening. We told you before about some of the problems of historic contamination of urban soils, and most people live in cities, so that means that it's important to people. State universities have traditionally dealt with farmers, but now, because this expertise is needed for the general urban population that want to garden, this conference becomes important. There have been a few others in the last 10 years, but it's an increasingly important topic.
I'm going to try to bring Sally back on the line here. I'm going to hit the button very carefully. Yay, Sally, you with me, right?
Yes, I am.
All right, sorry.
That
drop. No, you didn't do it. It was all on this end. Dr. Cheney, you mentioned historic contamination. What do you mean by that in urban areas?
Well, think of Chicago. Remember you had a fire? Every building that was painted with lead, all that lead got dispersed in the community. The exterior paint of every old house, until we stopped having lead in paint in the 50s and 70s.
Well, when did we start having lead in paint?
Before 1900.
Before 1900. So, but you're saying that in the Great Chicago Fire, a number of those buildings had already been painted with lead-based paint.
I think so.
Okay.
I can't swear to it because I haven't done my research in Chicago, but it's in Baltimore, in New York, in Boston, every old city, because of just the natural materials people were using, the commercial materials, they end up on soil. Even if you don't scrape the paint, it powders off over a period of time, and the soil becomes enriched in those contaminants. And then the general urban stack emissions of all the fires in the heating and power and everything else emitted metals, and those were dispersed but settled out most in the cities. So cities, compared to the rural areas, cities are, I'd say, 100% of cities are contaminated, but the suburban areas, it's only a little bit, unless it was an old orchard where they used lead arsenate pesticide, in which case, a new suburb can be contaminated because of the historic land use.
And I guess that's a really good point, too. And maybe we can go to Dr. Hedirachi about this, that lead is not the only contaminant that people are dealing with, correct?
Yes. Lead is the most common contaminant, and there can be other contaminants such as arsenic, the copper, zinc, those type of elements, as well as some organic contaminants such as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Like I said, lead seems to be the most common contaminant you would see in almost all urban gardens present in elevated levels, elevated than what we consider as normal.
And how elevated? Because I understand that lead in the soil is naturally occurring, but at something like, you know, 20 parts per million. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. Inside an old man house, it can be above 10,000 parts per million.
I'm sorry, where, Rufus, where can you find it that high?
Beside an old painted house.
Oh, okay. Well, this is where I bring you guys in. And Sally, you and I talked about this, Sally Brown from University of Washington. We talked about this several years ago. I was writing a story for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. So I went out and I had my own yard tested for lead. Now, I live in an old neighborhood in Chicago with a bunch of tract housing, wooden tract housing. And my own house is probably 125 years old. So you can see where this is going, right? And I had I sent the tests off to two different labs. And I'm just going to tell you what was by the house. Now, we should start this by saying the EPA generally recommends, they don't actually have rules from what I understand, Sally, is that correct? But they have recommendations, is that how they put it?
Much more like guidance.
Okay, guidelines. Okay, yeah, just like the you know, those red and green lights when you enter a freeway, they're not really stoplights, they're just guidelines. Like, if you feel like stopping, go ahead. But the U.S., or rather the EPA says that for bare soil, 400 parts per million is deemed the upper limit for what you want to really expose your children to. 1,200 parts per million is what you want to expose an adult to. And obviously that's because children absorb this stuff more readily. And it has more consequences, serious consequences for children than it does for adults. Have I said anything wrong at this point?
It's also because children are much more likely to lick ice cream off dirty fingers than adults are.
Exactly. That we will get to that point in a second, Dr. Brown. So I did this test in my yard, and behind my house, and remember, we said 1,200 parts per million is deemed more or less acceptable by the EPA, or that's the upper limit. Let me put it that way. That's the upper limit of what they suggest you be exposed to. Behind my house, I did one test with one lab, and it was 2,300 parts, actually milligrams per kilogram, which is the equivalent of parts per million.
Right.
So mine was 2,300. That was one test. The other lab told me it was 6,500 parts per million. So I have to ask I don't know who wants to pick this up, why those two labs were different. And I will tell you, I looked at four different areas in the yard, and the lab's results were in ratio. I mean, they made sense. The one lab obviously was about showed three times as much contamination as the other lab, but it was consistent throughout. So it makes me think that they were finding the same thing, but just at different levels. And I asked, and it might have been you, Sally, I asked some soil scientists, I said, what did that mean? And that person said, well, one lab's test was just more aggressive than another. I'm not really sure what that means. Sally, do you have any idea?
Sure. There's most soil test labs that you send a soil to are used to testing for soil fertility. And so when you ask for soil lead concentrations, very often they'll use a fertility extract, which doesn't dissolve every particle in the soil, to get you a number. And in fact, there's been research done. One of the people presenting at the meeting is going to be talking about how you can use these fertility extracts to say if your lead in soil is at a safe level. If you really want to know to the last particle how much lead you have, they'll dissolve the soil in very strong acids, and that'll give you a total concentration rather than a more of a available concentration.
So we're dealing with two different things. One is available.
Potentially, yes. That could explain it.
So one was saying this lead is total lead in the soil, and the other one was saying it might be availability. And are we talking about bioavailability, meaning that the amount of lead that would go up into a plant?
Okay, so with lead, very, very important thing. The biggest hazard with lead is eating the soil. And if you want to, if you're concerned about lead in your soil because it might get into your plant, that's a much, much less significant, less of a concern. And that's something that can be pretty easily managed. Ganga has done a lot of work on this, and she might be a good one to answer this.
Ganga?
Yes.
Why don't you move forward with that and talk maybe a little bit about Dr. Brown just mentioned.
Yeah, we have conducted actually research on seven different sites in seven different cities in the U.S. And what we have been repeatedly seeing is we had those test sites had elevated levels of lead. Lead concentrations ranging from about back what we consider as background 20 to maybe even greater than 2,000 ppm. And what we do see is, again, repeatedly, only lead accumulation, significant lead accumulation occur in root crops. But we do not see leafy vegetables or fruiting crops absorbing lead. That means like some lead can, but even in the root crops, these lead levels are considerably low than what we observe in soils. And then what it tells is transferring from root to shoot and shoot to fruits are very, very low. So the only concern, if it is in doubt, I think one thing gardeners can do is avoid growing root crops directly in soil.
All right.
Make sure that, like Sally said, make sure that take every precaution to minimize indirect exposure to dust. Washing vegetables and washing hands, and then making sure that getting rid of adhering soil particles to surfaces of produce that they are going to consume.
All right. We are talking to three soil scientists here on the Mike Novak Show, Dr. Sally Brown from the University of Washington, Dr. Rufus Cheney from the USDA, and Dr. Ganga Hedirachi from the Kansas State University, and they're going to be speaking, all of them, along with a lot of other people, at an event called Soil in the City, Enhancing Urban Soils for Living Landscapes and Healthy Communities. The link is on my website, MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show. I do want to mention that one of my sponsors, Christy Weber Landscapes, is a sponsor of this event, and as a matter of fact, that's how I heard about it, but I'm very excited to be talking to these scientists. So let's get back to what we just said, and Rufus, I'm going to bring you into this. It seems to me, listening to you now, and from the research I have done in the past about specifically lead contamination, as we've pointed out already, there's more than lead in our soils that we need to deal with. But specifically, we're often concerned with lead because of the lead-based paints we had, because of the lead-based gasolines that were in the United States. And I found out through the EPA site just the other day, and I was kind of surprised at this, that lead, you know, we think of lead-based gasolines having been banned in the late 70s. The truth of the matter is the very last lead-based gasoline was in 1995. So with January 1st, 1996, we no longer had lead-based gasoline in the United States, and I had no idea that it was that recently.
I think that those were specialty uses like airplanes and so on.
Still, gasoline. You know, you would think that 20 years, it took them 20 years to ramp it down, and there was a lot of research before that. I mean, I want to thank Sally Brown, who sent me a link that's Time Magazine called Lead-Based Gasoline, One of the 50 Worst Ideas Ever. One of the 50 Worst Inventions Ever. And it sure sounds like it, Rufus.
It's no question, okay? But if I look at typical urban gardens, the most important source was the paint on the house. In the center of the city, of course, gasoline lead fell out from the air in every direction. So downtowns are always more contaminated than suburban areas. Mm-hmm. Suburban areas are not often so contaminated that it would affect how you garden. Let me come back to the issue. You said the word bioavailability, and again, thinking about it, plants is one way of thinking of that, but the other way of thinking is that children inadvertently, by hand-to-mouth play, eat soil or dust.
All right, let's stop there for a second. I'll let you continue, but I don't want to throw out terms and confuse the audience if they've never heard them before, and one of them is bioavailability. And that means basically the ability of a plant to absorb that contamination. Am I correct? Or a human being, I would imagine, too. Right.
Yeah. What we try to do is call the plant side phytoavailability or plant availability.
Okay.
And bio for the animal. And again, it's because of tradition in the government and so on. But bioavailability, depending upon the composition of the soil, more or less of the lead would be actually bioavailable. And we studied that by actually test feeding soil to people, as well as pigs and rats and quail and other animals, to find out if we can treat soils so that the lead that's in them is not nearly as dangerous. And that has been shown that by treating with phosphate and compost, we can significantly reduce the bioavailability of soil lead to people that might inadvertently eat soil. So actually, we find that garden soils have a lot lower bioavailability of lead than mine and smelter sites, which is what EPA traditionally looked at and thought about and developed all of their rules based on. Our group is much more interested in the mass of urban citizens and the fact that gardens, because people add phosphate and compost and grow plants, the lead is converted to chemical forms that are less bioavailable. So it's, you know, there's things that is less dangerous rather than more dangerous. But still, getting a proper analysis is always the first step to protecting your children.
I don't want to alarm people about this, and it sounds to me, again, based on what you folks are saying and what I have read in the past, that, and you've said this in so many words, and I just want to reiterate it, that the worst problem we have is with putting soil in our own mouths. And folks are going to say, well, I don't do that. Well, and then what they don't realize is that when they're working in the yard, they rub their eyes, they put their hands in their mouths. Kids certainly do it. They'll actually eat soil. We don't wash our vegetables properly, and so we ingest soil that way. So it sounds to me that the greatest danger we have is not from the fact that we might have so much lead, but that we actually ingest soil. And if we change our habits to make sure we're not doing that, we're relatively safe from lead poisoning. Does that make sense?
It does, Mike. But on the other hand, it's still smart to get it if you're in an area, particularly an older housing area, to get an analysis to find out whether you need to care.
No, go ahead, Gonga.
It's actually Sally. There's also very easy things to do. So if you, you before the start of this part of the program, you were talking about recycling.
Yeah.
Where I live in Seattle, all our food and yard waste is collected and turned into compost. That compost is a great thing to put on your soil. It'll make your grass grow. It'll make your plants grow. It'll also dilute the lead contamination because the compost is very low in lead. So if you start taking care of your yard by putting compost on the surface and using mulch on the areas where you have exposed soil, right away you've decreased your danger enormously.
Yeah,
And that is because, as you've mentioned earlier, there are properties in compost, as there are properties in phosphorus, that bind the lead and make it less bioavailable, meaning less likely for us to absorb it. And I have to ask, do we then just, you know, we pass it through, we eliminate it?
Exactly. It's an inert chemical that passes through with the rest of the feces.
Amazing.
The other part is when you put the clean compost on the surface, you're taking that high lead soil and you're burying it, making it less easy to access, less easy to turn into dust, less easy to get onto your hands.
And that's a really good point, too, for people working in community gardens and working in their own gardens in the city. Dust is a chief way that lead travels. Actually, if you have a lawn, it mitigates the dust. If you have, you know, if you're working in the yard, wetting down the soil can help prevent the spread of that dust. There are various strategies you can use to not be exposed so much to lead in your soil.
Yeah, it'll also make your garden grow better.
Yes, of course. And that leads us to something called biosolids, which I want to get to. And you guys are going to need to hold on for just a second. We're talking to Gonga Hedi Arachi from Kansas State University, Rufus Cheney from the USDA, Sally Brown from the University of Washington. I see we got a phone call coming in, and I think it's around this issue of biosolids. 773-763-9278 is our telephone number, and we will be back with our distinguished panel of scientists in just a second. But first of all, so it's only June 22nd. But I already have my July-August issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. What exactly does that mean? It could mean that I've entered a time warp. If that's the case, I want to go back to January of this year when my basement door blew open in minus 19-degree weather and reduced my collection of indoor tropical plants down there by, 100%. Or it could simply mean that I'm special. You could be special, too, if you got a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, because here in June, you'd be seeing into the future to July and August and reading the cover story about how to turn your garden into a paradise by moving tropical plants into it each growing season, assuming that they haven't been turned into tropical mush by a stupidly freakish once-in-a-30-year cold snap. Do I sound bitter? I'm trying to move on. Really, I am. Then there's my column on the inside back page of every issue. I save my bitterness for those 700 or so choice words. Pick up a copy of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine at locations all over Chicago. Better yet, get a subscription. Go to ChicagolandGardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545. Or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
This is Mike Novak with a message from the Illinois Hydrilla Task Force. Dense mats of aquatic plants at your favorite fishing spot or swimming hole can really get in the way of summer fun. You can help protect Illinois' lakes and streams by keeping a lookout for the aquatic superweed hydrilla. It's already been found in neighboring states and impacted boating, fishing, and water sports. To learn more, go to hydrillahunt.org and report any suspicious aquatic plants you find. Your neighbors and fellow water users will thank you.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine dedicated to healthy and sustainable living. Natural Awakenings is available monthly, and we provide the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings also talks about local sustainability, gardening and environment, energy conservation, and green living. We feature local news and a calendar to help you stay connected. I can guarantee that each month you'll discover a new health tip, a tasty recipe, a service in your neighborhood, something that makes your life better. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
That was me. I've said it before and I'll say it again. In the game of organic gardening, it's pirates versus bugs. You know what I'm talking about? It's Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew. Arr. Captain Jack's is organic, and this fast-working and effective product works two ways, on contact or when the insect feeds. Captain Jack's controls all kinds of insects like caterpillars, beetles, spider mites, borers, and more. You can use it on vegetables, berries, and other fruit, flowers, trees, and shrubs. Captain Jack's all-organic insect control comes in an easy-to-use dust or liquid concentrate, as well as ready-to-use and ready-to-spray containers that have built-in applicators. And, of course, read and follow label directions. Do it as a favor to me. Pick up some of Bonide's Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew today at Sonoris Brothers in Frankfort, Karp's Garden and Feed Center in Hobart, Indiana, and Red's Garden Center in Northbrook, or go to Bonide.com to find a retailer near you. Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. I'm very, very pleased to have on the phone a group of very distinguished scientists. And at this point, folks, I also need to recognize the man who helped me put this show together is Dr. Lockwinder Hundel, who's with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District here in Chicago. He's an environmental soil scientist, and he's also the chair of the conference Soil in the City, which goes on next week. And I understand you guys are doing very well and getting a lot of folks signed up for that. It sounds like it's going to be a fabulous conference. I'm going to try to stop by. I've got Sally Brown from University of Washington, Rufus Cheney from the USDA, and Gonga Hedirachi from Kansas State University. And what I'm going to do here, I know that if I try to bring in this phone call, I'm going to have to put one of you on hold right here. Our phones handle only three at a time. So, Sally, I'm going to put you on hold real quick. And you will be back. So, fear not. There you go. And I think I can bring in our caller. There we go. And that is Bernie. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Yeah, Mike. I got a question. Back in the 70s, I don't know if you remember the sanitary district giving away that sludge.
That I came to Chicago in 78. So this is probably a little, and these issues were not on my radar at the time, but why don't you
they were giving away sludge and I spread it out on a half acre in a garden and all that. I don't live at that home anymore, but I'm just wondering, has anybody ever, maybe I'm turning over some worms there.
I'll tell you, that's actually a good introduction to this question, Bernie, and I'm going to hang up on you so I can bring Sally Brown back. And I appreciate the question. It's really a good one. And Sally, you're back with us. And he says sludge, and that is a term that we now use, well, we call it biosolids, correct?
And there's a distinction. The material back in the 70s was not something that Chicago should have been proud of. High-end metals, great from a science perspective, not great from a public health perspective.
Okay.
What's happened now is you have a whole bunch of regulations that are science-based, and in fact, Rufus was one of the soil science geniuses behind these regulations. And combined with an excellent managed program and a beautifully managed program, the material Chicago now makes
has about tenfold less metals and more nutrients than it used to.
Rufus, do you want to talk about that? Why was this sub? Okay, and I think this has created a problem for us because I know people who I talk to now in 2014 who say, no way, biosolids are ever going in my garden. And I think they're holdovers from the 1970s when this was not being done right. What has changed?
Well, back then, they had a very aged material that was pathogen-free, but as Sally said, it was rich in metals. They called it New Earth. It was one of the board members thought it was a great idea and pushed, and they distributed it free of charge to people. Subsequently, it was stopped because it was contaminated. But within about 10 years from that time, the federal rules were imposed, and Chicago became an outstanding example of meeting the rules and making a high-quality product that's safe for gardens. They also do something we call composting, which is a way to kill the pathogen so that there's no pathogen concern. You couple that with the quality control of the regulation, and the new product is something that you could use safely in a garden. I wanted to clarify the issue about those old gardens that had New Earth applied. If they were extremely high rate of application and they were allowed to become very strongly acid, say pH 5.5, which is never recommended for gardens, there could be more uptake than we would recommend. Most people garden near pH 7 for obvious fertility reasons, and in that case, that even the old New Earth is not a hazard to humans. It has to do with bioavailability of cadmium in foods and eating a better diet because you're eating garden foods and so on. So I want to alleviate the concern of people who use New Earth might have. Another part of why we're less concerned is you can't grow 100% of your diet on a home garden. You just can't do it. You know, it's cold part of the year. You don't grow lettuce and spinach at 12 months. You grow it a couple of months a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get the exposures that would be required to cause disease from, say, cadmium. That has occurred in rice consumers who eat 100% of their rice from a contaminated field for 50 years. They get disease. We don't have any evidence to suggest that the New Earth use and normal gardening practices of pH 6, 5 to 7 could cause any harm even to very aged, long-term consumers of those garden crops. So please don't be so worried that you throw the baby out with the bathwater about using biosolids as a soil amendment.
Well, does Gonga or Sally, do you want to contribute something there? Because it sounds as if we have moved forward with biosolids. I know for one thing, one of my sponsors on my show, Milorganite, in Milwaukee, has been doing this for decades. They've been doing this since the 1920s. And they have addressed the issues of heavy metals in there.
In 1980, they stopped the master lock from discharging cadmium that was used to plate the insides of locks. And ever since they made the change to comply with EPA, they've had an absolutely low-metal, wonderful product.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
All right, hold on, one at a time. Gonga, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I was going to say that if we have, like Rufus mentioned, clean biosolids. Biosolids also one advantage of biosolids, even if it has high levels of cadmium or other potentially toxic elements. Biosolids also have material like they are rich in phosphorus, they are rich in iron oxides. So because of that, they have great ability to actually absorb these metals, elements in them, and making them unavailable for plant uptake. So biosolid has that advantage too. Sally, you were trying to say something.
And before Sally speaks, I think, Sally, you and I talked about this a couple of years ago when I was doing the story. I think you were the one who told me, you want to see crops grow? Use biosolids. I mean, it's just obviously they're rich in nutrients.
Yeah, so I was just going to say a program right next to Seattle is a smaller city called Tacoma. And Tacoma makes a very, very good biofuels product that they've been giving away and selling to residents for two decades, to the point where they have sweatshirts that say making neighbors jealous since 1991. And they have now a really fabulous program where the Tacoma biofuels soil product is available to all community gardeners. And what happens there is, because there had been a Superfund site in Tacoma, a lead smelter site. And so people are very aware and very concerned about lead contamination. Before a community garden goes in, the wastewater treatment plant tests the soil to make sure it's okay and to make sure that the lead and the arsenic are low enough. And then they make the Tagro soil product free of charge for community gardeners, and it's led to a really successful urban garden program. Number of gardens has gone from about 5 to well over 50 in the last 4 years.
All right, we've got a couple more phone calls, so let's go to the phones. This time, Ganga, I'm going to put you on hold so we don't lose you, and I'm doing this one at a time. We'll take JR. Let's see if we can get that. JR, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mike. My question to the panel would be, the biosolids, I've worked with the Metropolitan Water Reclamation for years. I think it's a wonderful product. They made great changes. There's so many beneficial uses for it, this and that, and then we come up against the Illinois EPA. And my question would be is that more the hurdle? Is it, you know, around the country we're hearing all these different things, but it goes back to Illinois. That they're not, that they just won't accept it. They won't take the data. They won't believe it.
So you're saying the EPA is a hurdle to using biosolids here in Illinois? And are you talking the IEPA or the national EPA?
No, IEPA.
Yeah, I'm gonna let you go, JR, and we'll get the answer from our guests here. Thanks for calling. It's a great question. Anybody want to address that?
If you want.
Sure, go ahead, Sally.
Okay, I know from working with the people in the biosolids program that there are a big series of regional, local regulatory hurdles. And I think on the one hand, you should be happy with your regulatory agencies that they don't want to make any mistakes and they want to be absolutely sure that they're being overly protective of public health. And I think that because of that really serious view they're in this case too cautious, and that it's going to take some time and some examples from outside the area to give them the confidence that it's really okay to change. I think what you're looking at is a very serious view of their mission and a little legacy of what happened 34 years ago.
Yeah, when you have something like that happens in a particular area like it did in Illinois, that's a setback, and then you get people's minds poisoned against the use of something like biosolids. And as I tell folks, you know, with 7 billion people on the planet, soon to be 9 billion, what else are you going to do with this? If you don't find a way to treat your own waste and recycle it, in the old days, we dumped it into the ocean. We put it into landfills. We have to be smarter than that. I would assume the three of you agree on that. But what about the idea of the latest argument against the use of biosolids is pharmaceuticals in the water supply, and the fact that we don't really know how to measure that, and we don't know the effect it has on biosolids. Rufus, do you have any thoughts on that?
I have some strong thoughts on that. There are in some industrial compounds like phthalic acids from plasticizers and so on that can actually accumulate in biosolids, some detergents. But they're not toxic. They biodegrade in the soil after you apply the biosolid. people who talk about being worried about pharmaceuticals, it's somehow it's beyond my understanding that you can, if it's a part per billion, and you take, you know, we take it as a pill, and we use it in the kind of parts per thousand is to get an effective dose in our bodies, and they're worried about part per billion or less because they can measure it. Working with EPA and others, we stress the issue of risk. If the amount, because these compounds in the biosolids or compost or soil, you know, plant residues that you put on from just plants have full of chemical compounds. Most of them are biodegradable rapidly as well. They're not taken up into the edible part of the plant. So I haven't yet found a pharmaceutical in biosolids that can reach the edible part of a plant in a level to even notice, let alone actually be concerned about risk of.
All right, that's a really good point. Let's take one more phone call. This time, I'm an equal opportunity putter on holder. Rufus, it's going to be you this time, and I hope I don't lose you. And we'll go to Laura. You're on the Mike Novak Show.
Yeah, hi, Mike. Sorry about your tropical plants. That sounds like it was horrible.
It was a ghastly scene, I have to admit.
Oh, darn. So my question is, if we can, put our own feces under, you know, in antibacterial treatments and get it clean enough to put on our soil, why can't we do that with dog poop?
That's a really good question, actually. I don't know the answer to that, Laura. I'm going to let you go and bring in our scientists again. Thank you for the phone call. It's a great question. Let us bring back, Dr. Cheney as well. Who wants to tackle that one about dog feces and cat feces?
Well, I'll take a hit. The issue is composting at home. If dog feces are composted that comply with the EPA regulation for biosolids, you could use them on home gardens and lawns without any question, and cat feces. But the problem is that most home composting does not stay above 140 degrees Fahrenheit for 5 days continuously to kill the pathogens that we like to have as insurance against any disease risk. So if there were a commercial program to do that and comply with the temperatures, it would be a perfectly good product. Maybe it's an opportunity, a business opportunity for somebody in the Chicago area.
Well, if we can do human waste, we can certainly handle dog or cat waste, I would think. And is the idea then that the biosolids we create from human waste, they are processed with that heat and with those those pathogens in mind?
Right, exactly. Absolutely requirement before they can market it, both that the heat treatment occurred and that they have to do random sampling for any pathogen residues.
All right. I'm going to take one more quick question. Sally, you're going on hold for the moment. And let's go to Matt. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I actually study organic contaminants in the environment. And one of the areas we look at is actually biosolids. And I agree with your guess that pharmaceuticals are not an issue with uptake of plants, but there are several industrial contaminants that are present in our systems that get into our biosolids that can bioaccumulate into the plants and get to levels that at least approach the limits that the European Union has set for contaminants, in particular fluorochemicals. These were the stain protectant and thing. Industrial chemicals that were also used in commercial products. And so while I agree that from a metal standpoint and a pathogen standpoint, biosolids are relatively safe, I wouldn't say that they're completely safe from a biosolid standpoint. We showed 20 years ago that the three major sources of PCBs to the atmosphere of Chicago were the Con Edison transformer yard, the wastewater treatment plant, and then the landfill where all the biosolids were applied. So there are other contaminants that can accumulate to levels in plants and vegetables that can reach health limits.
That's an interesting point. Matt, do you live in Chicago? You teach in at Minnesota?
No, I'm actually driving back from Indiana University, where my postdoctoral advisor was retiring. I was giving a talk, and I happened to be driving through, and so I was listening to your program and thought I should call in.
How fortuitous. I hope you listen to us again on some Sunday morning, because we stream live at MikeNovak.net and at Chicago's Progressive Talk.com. I'm going to have our guest respond to that. Well, actually, I'm going to keep you on just for a second. Gonga or Rufus, Sally's on hold at the moment. Did you want to address that?
Yeah, let me, because I did a lot of the development of the federal regulation on PCBs. Back in the 1970s and 80s, PCBs were widely used in society, and they were high. There were a few biosolids in industrial cities that were dangerously high. Since the regulation came in, and they prohibited any further use, biosolids have declined to very low concentrations. Now, the next aspect that's important is that PCBs and that kind of class of chemicals are very strongly bound in the soil, so that any uptake, which you find in the above-ground part of crops, is from volatilization rather than plant uptake. And it's trivial as far as risk to humans is concerned. The carrot, because of the large skin, the peel, there can be enough PCBs in soils, particularly, say, urban centers. The PCBs might be in the carrot peel. I recommend peeling. Some people don't want to peel their carrots. I think it's, well, you know, something everybody needs to do. If you live in the city, just on principle. But the PCBs are only in the peel. And if you were saying, if you were concerned about that kind of a thing, you could grow carrots and lettuce and spinach and herbs in a raised bed with clean new soil, and the whole rest of your garden could be used for all the other kind of crops where there's, like, grains and fruits and so on, but there's essentially no transfer of contaminants. So your caller is correct in the sense that we can show uptake in carrot peel, but it being a risk to humans is a whole other question.
Matt, I'm going to have to let you go. It was a great question, and I'm glad you're listening. I hope you listen again sometime. I'm quickly bringing back Sally, and I'm out of time here. Sally Brown from the University of Washington, Rufus Cheney, USDA, Gonga Hediarachi from Kansas State University. I'm looking forward to meeting you at the conference in person next week. All that information is on my website, MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show. Thank you all for being on the program this morning. I it was a great conversation.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, I'll be honest. I love Christy Weber because she's a sponsor of the Mike Novak Show. That's reason enough for you to stop by Christy Weber Farm and Garden at 2200 West Grand Avenue in Chicago, buy a couple of plants, and say, Mike sent me. But she and her companies do so much more behind the scenes in Chicago that they deserve some kudos. So, for instance, they're a sponsor of the Soil in the City Conference that I was just talking about. Come on, who does that? What garden center or landscaper steps up and says our urban soils are important and we need to put our money where our mouth is and support the scientists and universities and horticultural specialists who are gathering for 3 days next week in Chicago to talk about how to help ordinary people grow food? Christy Weber, that's who. For landscaping, go to ChristyWeber.com. For the garden center, go to CWFNG.com or spell it out, ChristyWeberFarmAndGarden.com, or find them on Facebook. Let them inspire you to create your own oasis.
Mosquito bites are painful and itchy, and mosquitoes can carry West Nile virus and other diseases. But there's an effective organic way to kill mosquitoes. Mosquito Dunks are America's favorite organic mosquito killer because they kill mosquitoes before they are old enough to bite. The active ingredient in Mosquito Dunks kills mosquito larvae before they become flying, biting, disease-spreading adults. Just float a donut-shaped mosquito dunk in ponds, birdbaths, fountains, rain gutters, or any place where water collects to naturally kill mosquito larvae. Mosquito Dunks are deadly to mosquitoes, but harmless to pets, people, fish, and other wildlife. Each mosquito dunk treats up to 100 square feet of water and will kill mosquito larvae for up to 30 days. So don't let disease-carrying mosquitoes ruin your summer. Stock up on mosquito dunks. You can find mosquito dunks and mosquito bits at home centers, garden centers, and hardware stores.
Boom, boom. That's it. Soil mania. is officially put to rest, and maybe we'll do it again sometime. But I hope that wasn't too much over folks' head. I thought it was an interesting conversation, and I like geeking out every now and then. And I've got this big crew here, Carol and Helen and Sarah, and we all get to do the end of the show. Get those microphones on, because it's time to say, you know, as we always say at the end of the program, go green or...
go home.
Go home.
All right, some people are faster than others. We'll see you next Sunday.